Welcome to Healthcare Du Jour, where we dish up and digest the latest in healthcare. For the next 30 minutes, sit back as we bring you insight, commentary, and discussion on trending topics to the table, all expertly served up by our host and his guests. Healthcare Du Jour is brought to you by Carium, the telehealth platform enabling healthcare's digital transformation, helping you care for people within the fabric of their daily lives. Now here's your host, Matt Fisher.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining as we dive into the hottest topics in healthcare. I'm your host, Matt Fisher. On the menu today is Stephen Cutberth, Head of Marketing and Brand Strategy at Point Health. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Hey, Matt. Excited to be here.
So, Stephen, it's great to have you on. And what I always like to do before getting into the main part of the conversation is to let my guests give a little bit more of a background as to who they are and what they do. So the floor is yours.
Awesome. Well, I listened to a few of the episodes and I know the routine, so hopefully I can follow in the footsteps of your great prior guests. So I'm Stephen Cutberth. Background on me, I literally grew up in healthcare. My dad's a dentist. My mom was the office manager, and I was the kid in the back who came out and played with the kids who were in the waiting rooms. So that was my job, maybe filed a chart or two every once in a while. But so grew up in healthcare, went to business school up in Waco at Baylor, and then after that ended up really through a few things, did an MBA program and got my first job in Austin at a company that is now called Digital Pharmacist, and they help independent community pharmacies kind of compete with the Walgreens and CVSs of the world. So it was a fun first job. And then to fast forward a little bit, now I work at a company called Point Health, and our goal really is to make healthcare easier to find, easier to understand, and easier to afford. And that's what we're trying to do. And we do that through a couple of things. What it looks like is a healthcare navigation service, a bill negotiation service, and then a mobile application that we're building out. We all together call that our smart healthcare platform. Our goal is to launch an app that will allow patients to, look at pricing in their area, procedures, look at doctors. We have an integration on pharmacy costs, help them identify hospitals in their area, really make it just, as I said, easier for a patient to find care that fits their needs. We've been going about that for about a year here, and I'm really enjoying it. So it's been fun.
Yeah. So, kind of as you just gave the background of, it sounds like you're very much focused on, I think some of the key topics right now of, kind of sounds like individual activation and individual engagement. Before we actually get more into that, I'm just curious, as you said, you kind of grew up in healthcare. So what inspired you to just stay in it? Because I feel like also being, a child of a medical household, without actually going into practice, it seems like there's some type of a drawback in, because I've got other friends who have similar stories.
It's funny. My dad is a dentist. His story is crazy how he even became a dentist. He actually was working at a chemical plant and he made a mistake and got fired and then was like, I think I'll be a dentist. And, went to school and became a dentist, which nowadays you could never do because it's so hard to get in dental school. But I grew up kind of in that world and I liked it. My dad helped people. I always thought it was cool what he did. And I valued him, and he was, seen as a pillar of our community in a small town, Texas. So I was always a fan. But, my dad, we talk about this now. He actually said, he was like, don't be a dentist. Because if you're a dentist, you have to sit in the chair and do the work all the time. You need to go into business, and then you can, have people work for you. And I was like, that's a good idea. And so I went to business school. And then, in business school, I kind of gravitated towards marketing because I wasn't good at finance. I wasn't really good at accounting. Economics was fun. But anyway, I ended up in marketing. And so, after having done that, doing an MBA program, I was kind of like, okay, well, now I need to get a job. But I kind of had this pull toward healthcare because I had grown up in it. I knew it. But I wanted to work in tech as well. That was something I was always, I want to work at Apple or something like that. And so I think what ended up happening is I was able to find a job that married the two. I was able to find a startup tech company in Austin that was helping people in healthcare. And I do, I think, kind of have a bit of a moral compass, where I kind of like working in healthcare because I feel like I can make a difference. And so really it just kind of pulled the three together, all of those things culminated in that role. So yeah, man, it's funny. I'll say this too. My sister's in dental school. She graduates next year. My brother's an undergrad. So we kind of just all ended up in the whole healthcare world. We're a healthcare family, I guess.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. It's actually, one of my oldest friend is kind of in that same boat where, he's one of three kids. Both his parents are doctors. Both of his siblings are doctors, but he's in the consulting business where he's, consulting in healthcare, but he's the only non-physician in the family. So it's kind of a similar path as you're describing for your family.
Well, it makes for interesting like family gatherings because my dad and my sister will be talking about like, well, the bicuspid molar really needs an M2 joint because if you did this, and then my dad will like try to explain to me what they're talking about. And I'm like, it's okay. It's cool.
Yeah. No, at some point you're like, I'm happy with the degree of knowledge and focus that I've got.
That's the other thing is I don't want to like be dealing with blood and stuff in the mouth, and that doesn't sound like fun. But anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. No, but it's kind of, as you were saying, it's, all different forms of being able to help people. And it's, I think as you said, just finding kind of that aspect to healthcare is just such a common, observation that I hear from everybody working in healthcare. But kind of coming back to what you were talking about and referencing, it's, kind of how are you seeing individuals being more, engaged within their own healthcare journeys, and what are some of the strategies that are enabling and promoting that outcome to occur?
Well, I think there's two like foundational things that are happening. There's many more than that, but I'll hit on two. One, there's been a trend toward, higher deductible models, coverage that puts a patient in a position where they have more out-of-pocket cost. Some people like to say they have skin in the game. And it's led to patients realizing, if I go to that, facility and that MRI is $5,000 and my deductible is $7,000, I'm going to have to pay for like a large chunk of that MRI. If I go to this one that's $400, wait a minute, I only have to pay $400. I should do that. So it's just kind of like a common sense, financial incentive for patients who have higher deductibles. And I was one of those at my previous job. I worked at a healthcare agency and, I think we had like a $5,000 deductible, which is not an insignificant amount of money. So I think there's just a financial trend that's occurred, and there's lots of reasons why that's happened. We don't have time to go into now, but that's one. I think another thing is you're seeing more and more in, whether it's, the NPR Bill of the Month or Kaiser Health News or the New York Times or Wall Street Journal or whatever, the media is covering how patients are being treated more. And I think that it's just brought more awareness to the general population that in many cases, patients are, I hate to say it, but they're getting screwed sometimes, by healthcare and by hospitals and insurance companies and you name the player in the industry, but it's just become more commonplace to understand. And I bet if you ask 10 people, 8 of them, 9 of them would know someone or have a story, of a relative who got stuck with a big bill. And that just kind of naturally lends itself to say, next time I'm in that situation, I'm going to think and be a little bit more engaged in the decision I make.
Seeing kind of the common sense behind that, what are some of the ways that people can be able to actually follow through on that kind of new end goal? Because I think it's still, while there might be the feeling of, saying, I'm recognizing that there are all these costs and I'm actually more responsible, there are still, I think as should be well known, a lot of barriers to being able to effectively protect yourself or be able or effectively, make good decisions.
Oh, there's a ton. And not to be cynical, but some of them are put there on purpose, but yeah, there's a ton of barriers that exist in that industry. And I think that's it. Like, it's hard. And if you're a patient and you're sitting in a situation where you need to take your kid to the doctor, and you're, whether it's an emergency or non-emergency, it's hard to make some of those decisions. And I think there's a certain feeling of helplessness when you just don't know. And you're like, where can I find the information? It's not out there. There's no, very little information available to me as a patient to know what decision to make. It even happened with my wife on her ultrasound when she was pregnant. Long story short, we ended up getting charged like $600 for the ultrasound that should have been $200. $400 isn't going to, bankrupt us, but that's frustrating. That shouldn't have happened, and I know this stuff. I should have been able to stop it, but I wasn't able to. And my wife felt, like shame in it. And she was like, she was frustrated because she's like, I should have known, but this is what happened to the patient. So all that to say, it's really hard. The information's not out there. In many cases, hospitals don't want it to be out there. And I'm not trying to make hospitals a bad guy. I have lots of friends who work at hospitals. I used to work with them. But if you look at some of the recent stuff that's come out with price transparency for hospitals, in some cases, they've, blocked Google from searching the pages that have the prices on them. They're very, very rarely put out there in a way that they're easy to navigate. Normally, they're kind of hidden in like the footer, or I think, ProPublica, someone did a study and it took, 10 plus clicks to get to the pricing page. And so most businesses, by the way, it's in the header. It's like pricing, you can go in there and say, okay, for that software, it's this. And so I just think there's a lot of barriers. I think it's really hard. And so that's what we're trying to do, honestly, with our company, is we're trying to take that hidden information, organize it in a way that it's actually helpful, and then present it to a patient so they can make an informed decision with information. But there's tons of nuance there. Like, you know, is this a bundled care? Is this an all-inclusive price? Or is this a, you know, the price at Seton is different than at, you know, Texas Free Market Surgery Center in terms of what they include. Like at Seton, you might also get the anesthesiology bill, and you might also get, you know, the whatever bill. And so it's just, it's really hard to show it to patients.
Yeah, no, I think you're dead on in terms of, you know, the difficulty of figuring out what exactly is covered by a particular charge. And, you know, as you said, the different settings of where the care might occur is going to influence what it is, whether it's, you know, inpatient, outpatient, ASC, or, you know, any other kind of combination. But, you know, I think one of the interesting points that you're implying is, and hopefully I'm not going to mischaracterize it, but, you know, with the potential scope of information along with the, let's say, less than ideal ways of being able to get at it, it almost feels like you're going to need kind of intermediary, third-party intermediaries who are going to help pull all the data from the health care delivery or other organizations within healthcare, and then be able to help run it through all the different probably analytical pathways for easier presentation to individuals.
There, because it's so complex, there's no one, you know, silver bullet that's going to solve it all. To give you a little background, part of our company, Point Health, is you know, we acquired and kind of were born out of a partnership with the Caris Group, which is a company that's done bill negotiation and healthcare navigation for 25 years. And so, you know, that model, it's a human-driven model. It's people. You call in, say, hey, you know, hey, Justine, I got this bill, what do I do? Or, hey, Justine, I need to get an MRI, what do I do? Where should I go? And our advocates would help those individuals. And so that's still there. Like, you still need that human-driven piece for folks who aren't able to access the information through, like, an application or a platform. So I don't think that goes away. I think what you have to do is you have to meet people where they are, and if they prefer to use an app to find pricing, do that. If they prefer to call a person, you know, give them that option. If they prefer to send an email, if they want to submit a form on the site, you just have to meet them where they are and give them options to find the care that they need. And yes, to your point, you know, gathering all of that information and displaying it in a way that's actually usable and helpful. It's incredibly challenging, and there's lots of ways, you know, you can do it with machine learning and, you know, data scientists and algorithms and things to pull that information together. But it's, yeah, there's no one easy solution. It takes a ton of work, and our CRO likes to say you're chopping the wood. It's like we're chopping the wood, you know, it's hard and it takes time.
Yeah, I feel like that analogy of chopping the wood applies to so many different aspects of healthcare, you know, which I think just keeps going back to the point that you keep making, which is there is a lot of complexity and arguably there's a lot of incentive, you know, longstanding incentives built into the system that don't align with efficiency. I'm not going to say not higher quality, because I think everyone, you know, I think if you talk to any clinician, they're always looking to deliver high quality care, but it's more that efficiency and the cost effectiveness, I think, are not always incentivized within the traditional system.
Yeah. What's the word? Is it the payer agent or the provider agent? The problem you have essentially is that, you know, you've heard that the person paying for the care isn't always the person receiving the care. Well, and I don't like that analogy, because the patient's paying, the employer's paying, but when it comes to the point of service, you know, the patient's often not like pulling out a $100 bill and passing it over. You know, that claim is going to their insurance. The insurance is going to cover the claim. But that creates an issue where the person receiving the care isn't incentivized necessarily to understand the care or the price or shop and all. So yeah, it's just led to this ballooning situation. And this isn't new. People have been talking about this since, you know, 20 years ago. It's just no one's figured out how to stop it or try to address it.
Yeah, no, and I think that's a good point where it's, you know, the system's kind of been allowed to continue along the path that it's been on for so long. And for those of you just joining, I'm talking with Stephen Cupberth from Point Health about, you know, so far we've been talking a lot about individual engagement. And, you know, Stephen, we're just starting to talk about, you know, how the system is set up and how it hasn't always or hasn't traditionally been kind of centered on, you know, encouraging the best decisions to be made, you know, and we've talked in the past about, you know, the industry transitioning to value-based care. You know, so are you seeing, you know, what are your thoughts in terms of how that can help change these incentives and maybe align better with what we were talking about in terms of more informed individual choices that are going to, you know, provide probably more financial benefit for individuals, especially, you know, as you were talking about earlier with, you know, high deductible plans becoming so commonplace.
Yeah, I think value-based care is a great thing. I should note, and I have to be careful here. So I did a program at UT that was a Master's of Healthcare Transformation, and we had a wonderful leader, Dr. Elizabeth Theisberg, who I just love and adore, and she's wonderful. And I don't want to screw this up because I want to make her proud. But you know, basically the way they taught it to us was that the value equation is essentially the change in health outcomes for that person and their family over the cost of the full cycle of care. And so, absolutely, you know, if you're a patient looking to receive positive changes in your health outcome, you know, you want to do that in a way that is going to be affordable. And she would talk about, you know, if someone came in, you know, with a knee injury and they couldn't go on a walk and they really loved walking, and you're able to fix that knee injury, like you really improve their outcomes and you improve their life. But if that cost them, and this is an exaggeration, $200,000 for whatever reason, did you help them? Like, are, you know, you helped them in terms of their ability to walk, and that's a huge quality of life issue. But if you now put them into a position where they're in debt the rest of their lives, or they can't afford that, they have to file bankruptcy, are you really helping them? And so yeah, I think, you know, those factors have to all be considered. But to kind of go back to what you were asking there, I think the idea of value-based care is so important. I think, you know, models that adopt it well, moving away from a, and I'm going to say this, everybody says it, you know, fee-for-service system where everything is like XYZ has a cost and you add them all up. It's needed. I mean, those systems incentivize doctors, and I'm not trying to make them the bad guy, but they incentivize everyone to figure out how to maximize your revenue per unit of cost, you know, per unit of care delivered in a fee-for-service system. And, you know, I think the idea of a value-based model that's more about like, did you help that patient here? And whether it's capitated and, you know, here's $1,000 a month and keep that patient healthy and there's upside and downside risk and all that stuff. You know, I think those are good things. I think the industry's maybe, there's people smarter than I can talk about this, but I think they've maybe been slow to adopt it because anytime you're changing your revenue model, that's kind of scary. And so I think it's, you know, there's been some challenges to adopting it, but I would love to see it more. I'd love to see more patients put in positions where they're able to receive true value and care at a price that is a fair value, not, you know, be forced to go to a situation where their health issue was fixed, but now they have a financial issue.
Yeah, no, I'm really intrigued by that definition because it's, you know, if I'm understanding correctly, it's, you know, I think you were saying taking more of an individual by individual approach of determining what is valuable to this individual, you know, by, you know, I think you were saying the impact of the outcome connected to the cost to them, you know, yeah, both immediately and long-term, which really seems like it's folding in kind of social determinant of health factors because you're trying to look at it more holistically. You know, so I guess the first part, is that a fair way to be thinking about it?
I think so. And if you, so the model that they, Dr. Theisberg and Scott Wallace kind of taught us was, as I said, the change in health outcomes over the cost of the full cycle of care. And then the kind of model they put around outcomes was really the three C's is how they called it: capability, comfort, and calm. And if you Google that, you know, Dr. Theisberg, comfort, capability, calm, value-based care, you'll find lots of articles they've written on it. But they're trying to, I think, measure outcomes not just in, you know, did you check these seven boxes that like Medicare requires you to check, but more after that patient, you know, went through care with you, are they now able to, is their capability improved? Can they do what they couldn't do before? Is their comfort improved and they're living a better quality of life? And calm, you know, can they move forward in a better place? And so if you read her definitions, she'll do a much better job than I will of describing it. But I like that idea of trying to define it in that way.
Yeah, no, and that definition, you know, naturally leads into the second part of what I was thinking about. And I think you already alluded to it, which is it's not necessarily a check the box approach to did you hit these particular quality measures? Because it, at least to me, it often feels like discussions around value-based care models then go to establishing quality measures and having to show that you were satisfying these different quality measures to be able to show that you're giving higher value care, which probably is not the case in a lot of instances.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's always the challenge, is how do you measure quality? But yeah, and you know, people have talked about patient reported outcomes and things like that to try to understand how to, and there are lots of great platforms out there to help with that too. I mean, you know, you've probably talked to some of those folks, but some of the models that allow you to really measure if you help that patient or not, more than just, yeah, I checked these seven ticks off the requirements.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, arguably, you know, trying to focus more on, you know, what outcome and how did you change it and how is that, you know, again, going back to that definition of how is that compared to the full cost of care, I think as we're probably both saying it, that's a lot more challenging to be able to define and quantify when it comes to dollars and cents. But at the end of the day, theoretically, that should result in everybody feeling better, because if you can, you know, maybe it argues in favor of having more of a bundled approach or a capitated approach, as opposed to trying to say, we're going to incentivize you to do these certain quality things. Because maybe trying to hit that standard quality measure is great for one patient, but detrimental for another. And if you're just being held to that one standard, it's going to look like you're all over the place, even if your patients are doing better.
I think so. And I'm a fan of, you know, bundled pricing and direct contracting and anything that makes it less complicated and, you know, clearer and simpler for the patient and the payer too. I mean, you know, whichever party you want to focus on. And even the doctors. I mean, gosh, you talk to doctors, they hate dealing with all that stuff. My dad's got a whole, you know, person who just deals with insurance all day long and, you know, they can't stand it. I don't know. I joined a direct primary care practice here in Austin. It's called Euphora Health, Dr. Chris Larson. It's awesome. My wife just joined it, and it's essentially a monthly fee. And you just pay, you know, I think it's like $70 a month or something. And if you need care, you just message them. And you don't have to worry about it, all the other stuff. They don't file insurance. They keep a really lean system. And so I think that's a model. You and I have talked about like disruption and things like that. I think that's a model that's moving to disrupt a traditional, the way that primary care has become to be delivered. Like direct primary care is a way to disrupt that. And I actually saw a stat that said, I think it was for the first time ever, less than 50% of primary care practices are owned by physicians. They've all been bought up now. You know, more than half are bought up.
Yeah, no, I saw that same thing. I think it came out of the from the American Medical Association. Yeah. As you're saying, that it was, you know, we're recording this in early May, and I think it was this week that it came out that it was over 50% of physicians are employed by non-physician-owned practices. And, you know, so it's kind of interesting because, you know, combining that with what you were just talking about with direct primary care, you know, it would be great to get your thoughts in terms of, you know, how do you think the disruptive lessons from that model could potentially be extrapolated across the system, because, you know, I don't think DPC is going to be a solution for the system, because if you try to do that, you're going to need like
a lot of
many, many more physicians than are currently being trained to go into primary care. You know, so combining that along with the fact that fewer physicians are running their own practices, and I think the piece that gets lost is not only are they not owning it, but their happiness is also not increasing, because employment by a system comes with its own headaches.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Larson, I'll answer your question, but Dr. Larson, he's become kind of a friend. You know, we message and stuff, and he was telling me he jokingly described himself as like doctor, HR, janitor, billing, accounting, front, you know, he had a lot of slashes in his name, you know, not just MD or DO or whatever. Which is hard, right? Because then, you know, the doctor has to do far more than they might do in another situation. But there's a level of ownership there. There's a level of, like, if I need to make a change, I can just do that. I don't have to go through this whole system to make it happen. So I think there are benefits to doctors who decide to go down that road. Your question, though, is, I mean, it's you asked the right question. It's the million-dollar question. How can you scale DPC? And I think, you know, Dr. Larson and others are thinking about that, and they're trying to figure it out because, like you said, you know, patient panels can only be so large. You hit some issues there as you try to grow it. So does that mean, you know, you pull in some nurse practitioners or physician's assistants and, you know, other caregivers who can operate at the very top of their license? You know, maybe there's something there, but I don't know is the honest answer. I you know, there's obviously a question of like equitability, and I would like to see more people have the option or ability to have the kind of relationship you have with a doctor in a DPC model across the board. Because I can just tell you, you know, my whole life I've gone to traditional medicine in the model we have, and everyone knows this, you get 10 minutes maybe, and you get to talk about one thing. But in my experience with more of a DPC model, you really get more time, and you can, there's more flexibility there. And so, yeah, if we can scale that, man, we could be rich, because we need to figure out how to do it. And so if any listeners know, like, let's figure that out, because I would love, and even beyond being rich, I think you'd be able to help a ton of people get access to a better model.
Yeah, no, and I agree with you. That's kind of that million-dollar question, because it's, you know, with the turn that you see in patients in a daily, you know, kind of schedule for physicians, the physicians aren't happy with that because they want more time to be able to interact and not feel like that's rushing. Because, you know, the training there is, and I hear this from my wife, who's a primary care physician all the time, it's, you know, if you hear something, you're going to talk about it, but then all of a sudden you're 30 minutes behind, and then that impacts everybody else, and you feel bad for them. So it's just this cascading effect. But, you know, the problem also is, it's, you know, and I think this was kind of maybe going back a little bit in our conversation, but, you know, it was a selling point for value-based care a few years ago, which is, oh, there's not that pressure to have to turn through patients because, you know, you're going to get a capitated payment in some of the models, so you don't have to turn through. But at the same time, the bigger practice groups are like, well, we need more patients now because we need to get more of that per member per month payment. And the bigger your panel is, the more likely it is that people are going to want to come in, so you have the same problem.
Yeah, I think that's true. And like Dr. Larson, they added a second doctor. His wife's a doctor, actually, so it worked out well. So they have two. They're both now in the practice with him. And I know for a fact that they've been looking to hire additional ones. And I think that is you start to hit some of those growing pains, and then you have to figure out, how do you solve them? And again, is it bringing in additional, you know, caregivers? How do you handle that? I mean, that's hard with any practice that's growing, I think. But I just know that model, to me, seems like a better model than the model that we've evolved to. And I mean this, like, I would love to spend some time trying to figure out how to make that work. And I think lots of people are, because it's just, as a patient, it's far superior.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. And believe it or not, we're already just about out of time. So I'm going to close with one final question. Just ask, what has you most optimistic about healthcare right now?
I mean, it's conversations like this, you know, and we do a podcast at Point Health as well. And every one I end up feeling a little bit depressed at one point in time in the conversation, because I'm like, geez, everything sucks. But it's then the like, oh, but what about this? And oh, but what about this? And I ask a similar question. And so it's all the people that are working hard and trying to do something different. It's all the people, you know, the brokers out there who are not just trying to raise premiums every month, but instead work with their clients to set up a self-funded plan and a different model. And it's the health sharing organizations that are taking a different approach, and the doctors who are opening DPC practices, and like all those things that are happening. It's still small, and it has a feel of a David versus Goliath, you know, like the small little folks trying to fight against the machine. But I'm hopeful that those small little folks in the end will be able to make a dent, and that dent will grow, and we can continue to kind of create ripples, because, I mean, what's the alternative? You know? No.
I like that message of, you know, we just got to keep trying and going in different directions. But, you know, believe it or not, we are already out of time. I want to thank my guest, Stephen Cutbirth, for a great conversation today.
That's really fun. I appreciate you having me, Matt.
Yeah, no, it's great to have you on. And thank you to everyone listening. Keep the dialogue going and connect with me at #HCDEJURE. I'm Matt Fisher. Until next time.